Good afternoon. So this morning we spoke about how Buddha Shakyamuni taught us this profound method to attain freedom from samsara. And Buddha Shakyamuni identified the causes for our suffering and our remaining bound within cyclic existence, which are our various afflicted minds. And with the root of these afflictions is our ignorance of self-grasping. And it's that mind that keeps us trapped here. And until we manage to abandon this root cause, we will not be able to attain liberation from suffering. And then moreover, the Buddha taught us the method to attain liberation, how we can actually attain freedom from suffering. And that is through developing the mind that is contrary to the ignorance of self-grasping, and that is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. And how to do so, how to develop this mind, that is through the method of contemplating on dependent arising. So therefore, the wisdom realizing emptiness and the wisdom realizing dependent arising, these two minds, which are harmonious and complementary, and the one aiding with one aiding the other, this is the method by which through its cultivation we will attain freedom. And if we utilize this meditation with the motivation of bodhicitta, not only will the meditation on dependent arising serve to strengthen our minds of love and compassion and bodhicitta itself, but then we are accumulating the causes to attain complete and full enlightenment itself.
And
moreover, we looked in the 22nd verse that non-Buddhists do not accept dependent arising, and not accepting dependent arising, they cannot understand that phenomena lack inherent existence. But moreover, they actually accept that phenomena are inherent to existence. They do exist by way of their own essence. And due to this view of theirs, when they hear the Buddha's presentation of dependent arising and lack of inherent existence, they criticize the Buddha himself as well as his teachings, the Buddha Dharma. And this is because they accept the view of inherent existence.
Oh, yeah, that in
Now we'll continue where Lama Tsongkhapa moves his attention from non-Buddhists to Buddhists. And amongst Buddhists here, he's specifically looking at the non-Prasangikas, so the Svacantika and below. Because here, in this next verse, he's going to express his surprise that these Buddhists, the non-Prasangika Buddhists, they don't accept the lack of inherent existence. The 23rd verse, having accepted dependent arising, the crown jewel of your teachings, you cannot bear the roar of emptiness. I do find this to be most astonishing. We start with the second line, the crown jewel of your teachings. So what does this refer to? What is seen as the crown jewel of Buddha's teachings? Well, the Buddha, as we know, taught a vast array of teachings, and they were all motivated so as to enable beings to eliminate suffering and achieve happiness. So in order to achieve this this heartfelt wish of being separated completely from suffering and attain lasting happiness, the Buddha taught many different methods. He taught about impermanence, he taught about suffering and its causes, he taught about selflessness, and many other teachings. But amongst the vast array of teachings that the Buddha gave, of all these many methods to attain liberation from suffering, the most precious is that phenomena lack inherent existence, that they are empty of inherent existence, and that the way to come to realize this is through dependent arising. So therefore the crown jewel or the essence of the Buddha Dharma is that all phenomena lack inherent existence, and the way to realize this is through dependent arising. As an alternative to crown jewel, we can refer to a cherished treasury. So a treasury then would be perhaps a vast pile of precious jewels or things that are held dear. So if one was to look at the Buddha Dharma as being like a treasure of jewels or a treasury of jewels, then amongst these, the crown jewel or the supreme jewel, this then would be the teaching on dependence arising. And the reason why dependence arising is being emphasized here is it's because through coming to realize dependence arising in a profound way, coming to realize the subtler and subtlest levels of dependence arising, this will aid one's a realization of cause and effect, of impermanence, and of emptiness. So all these other extremely important jewels within the Buddha Dharma, that of cause and effect, impermanence, emptiness, these are all strengthened through the realization of dependence arising. Hence, it can be referred to as the crown jewel amongst the treasury of the Buddha Dharma. This method to attain liberation, that of the presentation of dependence arising, the non-prasangikas, they accept this. So Jerenpache here is saying directly to them, you accept that the presentation on dependence arising, and you accept that this is a technique to attain liberation from cyclic existence. And moreover, you as holders of the philosophical views of either the Svajantika or the Chittamadran or the Svajantika or the Vaibhashika philosophies, you all accept that Buddha Shakyamuni is a Buddha and therefore has perfected all good qualities and completely eliminated all faults. And therefore you have great faith and conviction in the Buddha.
When the Buddha taught dependence arising, he used this as a skillful technique to show the validity of his teaching on how all phenomena lack inherent existence. When he taught dependence arising, he used this to show that all phenomena are therefore empty of inherent existence. However, you non-prasangikas, when you hear teachings on dependence arising, you hear that teaching and think, ah, this establishes that all phenomena are inherently existent. Because they are dependent arisings, they are inherently existent. Whereas that's the opposite of the Buddha's intent, which was, because phenomena are dependent arisings, they lack inherent existence. So you're understanding that dependent arising, your understanding of dependent arising leads to a mistaken final understanding.
今天人家那三月中的这个缺他们家让心马主巴的送外地的，像这个你三月中的这个送脚的，那个广播机里怕这些，你带起心把一把开灵的没多少。广播开。三月广播，三月中的这个缺他们家让心马主巴的送有了，毕竟忙不拿了。这送外地缺让这个广播现在机里怕这些，这些现在就谢谢让心马主巴来开灵的没多少事儿，可这些现在几个老黄这个。
Furthermore, when you hear in the sutras of the Buddha, where he teaches that phenomena are empty of inherent existence, you don't accept these teachings. This is not the view of the Buddha that you accept. When the Buddha taught that phenomena are empty of inherent existence, this was something you don't accept. What I'm finding amazing here, says Lama Tsongkhapa, is that you accept Buddha Shakyamuni, not just accept him, you accept that he is a Buddha, and therefore he is faultless. He has completely eliminated all faults and developed all good qualities to a level of perfection, and thereby have great faith and trust and conviction in the Buddha. And moreover, in his teachings, you accept dependent arising, but you also accept inherent existence. You accept that whilst phenomena are dependently arisen, they are inherently existent. And this truly amazes me, says Jairam Pusey.
So
similar to this, the illustration we had this morning, when if someone who you know doesn't know how to cook and what ingredients go well together, if their food is not so tasty, not a big surprise. And likewise, if someone who is a skilled cook and has accumulated the ingredients that go well together, if they then put together a meal that is also not tasty, then one would be surprised. So similarly here, Jairam Pusey is saying, with regard to the non-Buddhists, they don't accept they don't accept Buddha, so they don't accept that Buddha Shakyamuni is faultless and has perfected all good qualities. They don't thereby therefore have faith or trust in the Buddha. And they don't accept his teachings on dependent arising and believe that things are inherently existent. Or rather, they don't accept Buddha's teachings on dependent arising and they don't accept Buddha's teachings on the lack of inherent existence. So this doesn't surprise me, because if as non-Buddhists, they don't accept these things doesn't surprise me. But you, as Buddhists, who see the Buddha as a Buddha, as thereby faultless and having perfected all good qualities, and you accept Buddha's teachings on dependent arising, but you don't accept Buddha's teachings on that all phenomena lack inherent existence, this I find truly amazing. And that's what Lama Tsongkhapa is saying here in these two verses, this 23rd verse now and the 22nd verse earlier.
Then
Thank you, Pa Kwonso. Yopade, Rangshin Madrupade.
Yopare, Rangshin Yopa Mare.
Then in Mepa?
Rangshin Yubade, Yomare. In a Meba Mare. This is what that.
So this difference then between in the Buddhist philosophy, if we're dividing between the prasangika and the non-prasangika, is how they are able to make a distinction between inherent existence and existence. So for non-prasangikas, they believe that if something is inherently existent, that means it exists. Or to put it, just swap those terms around, they believe if something exists, it is inherently existent. It exists by way of its own nature. And moreover, if something is then empty of inherent existence, it's non-existent. It doesn't exist at all. So this is the view of the non-prasangikas. If something exists, it has to have its own nature, and therefore it's inherently existent. If something lacks inherent existence, it cannot exist. So that is the view of the non-prasangikas. For the prasangika, the highest philosophical school, they are able to make a far subtler a distinction. And they can see that something that exists, exists whilst lacking inherent existence. So their understanding is quite different. If something exists, it lacks inherent existence. That's the view of the prasangika. The non-prasangika, if something exists, it is inherently existent. So that is the key distinction between them. And likewise with prasangika, if we swap the words around, if something is empty of inherent existence, that doesn't mean it's non-existent. It still exists because that's how phenomena exist. They don't exist by way of their own nature. They lack inherent existence. So that is the key distinction. The non-prasangikas believe that if something is lacks inherent existence, it's non-existent. Whereas if something exists, it has to be inherently existent, existent by way of its own nature. Whereas for the prasangika, they are able to make a far finer distinction and see that something that exists is necessarily empty of inherent existence.
The other Jerem Chicken on the Digi, Labja, Karendangore, Labna, Chisa, Anjuke, Sanya Chimden, the Tinjin, Joe, Chumare, Chisa, Che, Kanichin, Chenchil, Tuni, Tubare, Tuni, Yobare, says Sungor was, Chisa Dininza, Tuni, Yobare, Sungodu, Ranshin Yoba, Chis Ranshin Yoba, and Chida Yoba in the Chapa Chowores.
Do you understand?
여바이나
What Jenpuche is teaching us in this verse is that Buddha Shakyamuni taught that all phenomena are dependent arisings, and they're dependent on causes and conditions, and all dependent one thing on the other. So when we're saying all phenomena are dependent arisings, this means that everything that exists is a dependent arising. And as has been said, if it's a dependent arising, it's dependent on something. Therefore, it cannot be independent, because if it exists, the Buddha taught it is dependent. So if it exists, it's dependent, and therefore cannot be independent. If it were independent, if an existent were independent, then it would be inherently existent, like the non-prasangika belief. But here, Jerome Fischer is pointing out to us the sequence that if something exists, it's a dependent arising. If it's dependent, of course it cannot be independent. And then, what does independent mean? Inherently existent. So in this way, he's pointing out the faults in the understanding of the non-prasangika.
What we're linking back to now is what we spoke about last night and in the previous weekend about what does it mean, how would something exist if it existed inherently. So if something were inherently existent, it would be independent. It would be unchanging. If something were inherently existent, it wouldn't rely on anything else. It would exist by its own nature. It wouldn't need to rely on causes on conditions or on something other than itself. That would be an independent phenomenon, and that would therefore be inherently existent. And second, the second characteristic to being independent, it would be unchanging. So that's why we've just heard in the previous segment that everything that exists, the Buddha taught, is a dependent arising. So it's dependent, not independent. And therefore, it is not inherently existent, because the meaning of inherent existence is independent. And then furthermore, the Buddha taught that all phenomena lack inherent existence. So in the previous segment, we looked at how all phenomena that exist are dependent arisings, and now we're looking at that all phenomena that exist are empty of inherent existence. But that doesn't mean they're non-existent, because we're talking about phenomena that do exist. All phenomena that exist are empty of inherent existence, but still exist. And how so? They exist dependently, dependent on causes and conditions, or dependent one thing on another. So what then doesn't exist?
What doesn't exist is a phenomenon that is independent. Rather, phenomena are dependent. What doesn't exist is inherently existent phenomena. Rather, phenomena that exist lack inherent existence. So if we take our body, if this body were inherently existent, it would have those two characteristics of inherent existence. It would be independent, nothing else could influence it, and it would be unchanging. It would have those two characteristics. That type of body, this inherently existent body, this doesn't exist. But it doesn't mean we don't have a body. Of course there's a body here, the body exists. But what doesn't exist is an inherently existent body. What we have is a body that is dependent. This we have. We have a body that is a dependent arising, dependent on causes and conditions.
Here you may well be thinking that within the great scholars of that are included amongst the non-prasangika, these are people that are highly educated in the Buddha's teachings. We aren't as educated as they are. So how can they view their body as being inherently existent and having these characteristics of being independent and unchanging, when we ourselves, who aren't nearly as educated as them, we know very clearly and very easily, in fact it's obvious to everyone, that this body does change. It is dependent on causes. For example, it's dependent on food, it's dependent on clothing, it's dependent on the care of others. And it has, so it's clearly not independent, but dependent. At no point can we say this body was unchanging or is unchanging. It has changed so many times from conception to now. So how can it be that us ordinary people can understand this so clearly, but these highly educated masters within the non-prasangika philosophical schools seem to miss this point? And yes, that this is a good question to contemplate, because of course they know this. And moreover, they know this in the external world too, in that they would have been involved with the establishments or the development of monasteries and therefore the building of many constructions. And they know that these came about independent on causes and conditions. They aren't independent, but required the coming together of many different causes and conditions. And these tables that we have here, you know, these non-prasangikas, they will of course also know that these tables aren't unchanging and they aren't
independent, but rather many causes came together. They can be broken down into their parts, but the causes came together, creating a table. But yet they will say, this table is inherently existent. Prasangika, just like the non-prasangikas, they of course know that this table came together through many causes and conditions and parts coming together. So they have the same knowledge there, but they then point to the same table and say, therefore, it lacks inherent existence. So when the Prasangika, non-Prasangika agrees, they'll look at a phenomenon, for example this table, and they'll agree many causes and conditions came together and that led to there being a table, no disagreement. But the non-Prasangika will say, therefore this table exists inherently. The Prasangika will say, therefore this table does not exist inherently. So that is where the difference arises. And they come to this different conclusion. Because, so to look first at the non-prasangikas, they will, when they in their meditation investigate this table, and they will investigate all its various causes that led to the arising of the table, and they investigate each cause in fine detail, they will say there is a findable essence to each and every one of those causes. Why? Because that cause exists. If that cause did not exist, then it would have no inherent nature. Or conversely, if a cause didn't have an inherent nature, it couldn't exist, because the lack of inherent existence equals non-existence. So this is how the Svatantika, the non-prasangika, come to the conclusion that something that is a dependent arising exists, and if it exists, it exists by way of its own nature, because if you investigate the phenomenon or its various causes, each one exists and therefore exists by way of its own nature, its inherently existence.
지금 그런 당번에 유지 고려스 지금 유지 예능 안 얻을 될이야 즉 소셔 당지드니 이제 잘라셔야 돼 자마를 쇠 두고 그래서 그럼 그런 뭐네 당번에 유지 매나 맞아 쇠 하나 요 말해라 그걸 내가 먼저 딜해 걸 와다 랑원이 주바세리 그런 랑원에 그 유지디 당보 그런 원에 주비 유지 여 같이 내량 안 지금 파네 버라 잡지네 자마라 쇠 신이 잘라 자마라 쇠 용고 그래서 같이 시기로
So if they investigate at the table, they'll know the table is made from a substance, so we say wood. It's a wooden table. And from this material, this substance, this was a cause that led to the table. So dependent on this and many other causes, one eventually got a table. So they investigate the cause, which is this material, and they would say the wood that later became the table, that exists. That wood exists. And if it exists by way of its own nature. Therefore, that wood exists, that wood which is the cause exists. And therefore, the wood or the cause, this is inherently existent because whatever exists, exists by way of its own nature. And that is how they come to this view.
You met 제
The illustration they give to show this in the classical text is they use the illustration of an illusion. So the way the magic was performed in the ancient past is a magician would cast a spell or say some mantra onto a substance, onto a basis. So the illustration that's given in the classical text is on the basis of a stone, then the magician says some mantra, and then a magical illusion appears of an elephant. And this looks like an elephant in the room, but this is just an illusion. But this illusion was created by the magician through mantra onto a basis of the stone. So for this, once you achieve this result of this magical illusion, a basis was required, and that was the stone. So this basis is required, the cause, this basis which is the cause is required for there to be a result. And therefore, that exists, that cause exists. And when you have all the different components coming together. So you have the basis, you have the magician casting the spell, you then get the result of the illusion. And that is how everything comes together. Whether there are flowers in the garden, or humans, sentient beings, they all come together. When all the causes come together, the result comes about. And for this result to come about, those causes have to exist. And being existent means they are inherently existent. What is then the meaning in this verse that Chairman Pichet is sharing with us? So we've heard that the Buddha teaches that all phenomena that exist are empty of inherent existence. before we can know that what it means for a phenomenon to be empty of something, so to be empty of inherent existence, we have to understand what is meant by inherent existence. So this is the starting point. Just like we've heard in the presentation on the meditations, how does the self appear to the mind as inherently existent? We need to have this understanding of what is meant by inherent existence. So this is the starting point. We need to, before we can understand emptiness, we must understand what phenomena are empty of. So therefore, he's teaching us here that if something existed inherently, it would have these two characteristics. Firstly, it would be independent. And then what does being independent mean? It would not be affected by anything. It wouldn't be affected by, for example, causes and conditions. Something other than it would have no impact on it. It would be independent. And the second characteristic then is that it would be unchanging. So all phenomena lack this. Everything that exists, the Buddha taught, lacks inherent existence. It lacks these characteristics of being independent and unchanging. Moreover, though, this doesn't mean that phenomena do not exist at all. What the Buddha taught is that phenomena do not exist inherently. The Buddha didn't teach that phenomena do not exist at all. Rather, what doesn't exist is inherent existence. And if inherent existence doesn't exist, there's no inherent existent phenomenon. So to come to understand this, we need to receive many teachings, and not only receive teachings, but reflect again and again on these teachings, so that we can, so that through applying this understanding to a wide variety of inner and outer phenomena, we can come to subtler and subtler understandings how no phenomenon exists inherently. That inherent existence is what is non-existent doesn't mean that phenomena don't exist at all. And that understanding can only arise within one in a profound way, hearing many teachings and reflecting repeatedly on these teachings onto a wide variety of objects. Now the 24th verse. Dependent arising is the incomparable entranceway leading to non-inherent existence. But these people, through that term itself, grasp at inherent existence. The meaning of the first two lines in is, as it says here, that it's through reflecting on the presentation on dependent arising, through reflecting on this supreme of methods, that one will pass through the doorway leading to the realization that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence.
Then 地方要的那塔巴的他们这些没有搞不好，偷偷过来是。现在今年人家塔巴的他们这些没有搞不好，特别阿拉，特别阿拉，那些马祖巴的马多巴呢，都被东西都被落的马公巴呢，偷偷也要买来是。现在那些没把，都被东西都被落公巴了，这东西多过来，东西多巴了，东西多一个塔拉没下手的，那点钱就要就上当多过来是的，上一个的送过来是的。
Looking further at these first two lines, that is through repeatedly reflecting on dependence arising, that our understanding of emptiness of inherent existence grows. And if we embark on this journey of repeatedly over a sustained period, reflecting on how all phenomena are dependence arisings, they're dependence either on causes and conditions, and or on one thing in dependence on another, through repeatedly reflecting on how this is applicable to everything that exists, we will come to see that all phenomena are not only dependent arisings, but they lack inherent existence. And as we engage in this meditation, repeatedly over a sustained period, our understanding will go from the coarse to slightly subtler, and then subtler and subtler levels. And as our understanding of dependence arising and emptiness strengthens, the contrary mind, that of the ignorance of self-grasping, this proportionately weakens. And the way we can think of this is as a scale. So as our wisdom on the one side grows, our wisdom of realizing dependence arising and the wisdom realizing emptiness, as this grows in weight, then the contrary mind of ignorance of self-grasping, this proportionately weakens. And that then means that as our ignorance weakens, the resulting afflictions that come from this become less frequent and less powerful, as is then the contaminated karma that they accumulate. And therefore, our attainment of our goals of liberation and enlightenment, these come ever closer. So this is comes about independence and repeatedly meditating on dependent arising and emptiness. Without developing this wisdom that realizes emptiness, it's impossible to attain liberation from samsara, impossible to attain enlightenment. And the very best way to realize emptiness is, as it says in these first two lines, is to pass through the incomparable entranceway of dependent arising.
Mingi kine, Rashindu, Zinna, Dekoki, Otis.
The third and fourth lines. But these people, through the term itself, grasp at inherent existence. So this is referring to those who accept dependence arising, but their understanding of dependence arising is coarse, it's elementary. They do not have anything approaching a subtle understanding of dependency. And therefore, whilst they accept dependence arising, it can be said that they accept it in terms of accepting the mere words, the mere name of dependent arising. And that is because their understanding is still so coarse. And through their acceptance and reflection on dependent arising, it actually leads to their view that phenomena that exist must exist inherently. That view only strengthens. So this is a result of them accepting dependent arising, but in only accepting it in terms of its mere name, but not coming to understand the subtler meanings of dependency. These practitioners, whilst they may be engaging in meditation on dependence arising, this meditation is not leading them to develop a more profound understanding of lack of inherent existence. Rather, it's just leading to their grasping at inherent existence being strengthened, or their view that phenomena that exist must be inherently existent, strengthening. And therefore, of course, if their view that phenomena that exist are inherently existent, if this is remaining, and it's remaining unchallenged but is only strengthening, it's impossible for them to realize that phenomena are empty of inherent existence. And if they can't realize that phenomena lack inherent existence, there's no way that they can harm the ignorance of self-grasping, that ignorance which is the very root cause of us remaining bound and trapped within cyclic existence. Hopefully you're seeing that these two lines here, the last two lines in this verse, are referring to the predicaments that non-prasangikas find themselves in, those of not of the supreme view within Buddhism. So they are unable to attain liberation because they cannot abandon their ignorance of self-grasping. So they may be engaging in meditation on dependence arising, accepting that phenomena arise due to causes and conditions, but this then serves, but because of their faulty view, this serves to just reinforce their belief that something that is a dependence arising is an existent, and if it exists, it exists by way of its own nature or its own inherent nature. And therefore, it strengthens their view at inherent existence. And this view of inherent existence, this acceptance of inherent existence, this is not a mind that is contrary to the ignorance of self-grasping. So therefore, even though they're meditating on dependence arising, they are not harming their ignorance of self-grasping, and therefore remain trapped in cyclic existence. What we've heard then in these last few verses is that Jerenpuche has expressed understanding that non-Buddhists who don't have faith in the Buddha and thereby in the teachings of the Buddha, for him this isn't then surprising that they don't accept that phenomena lack inherent existence. And thereafter we heard that he doesn't have the same view towards the non-Prasangikas, because he says to them, you believe that Buddha Shakyamuni is a Buddha and therefore has completely eliminated all faults and developed all good qualities to the level of perfection. And moreover, you have faith in the Buddha Dharma, you accept the Buddha Dharma, for example, causality, impermanence, etc. But yet, you still hold to the view, believing, accepting inherent existence. And this I find surprising. So this we've heard in the preceding few verses. But we shouldn't then think that Lama Tsongkhapa here is doing anything more than expressing surprise that those who accept the Buddha and the Buddha Dharma still have this wrong understanding. He's not scorning them, he's not looking down on them, but rather expressing surprise. Rather, the point that the purpose behind Jerenpuche composing these verses and expressing his astonishment towards the non-Prasangikas is he's wanting to make the following point, that you accept dependent arising, you accept that phenomena that exist are dependent arisings, yet this understanding is leading to your ever strengthening grasping at inherent existence. The mistake, or to rectify this mistake, you need to do the following. You need to hear teachings on the Prasangika, and you need to investigate the validity or otherwise of these teachings. Investigate, think for yourself, and come to see whether these teachings are correct or not. And the starting point of this is to come to understand how a phenomenon would exist if it were inherently existent. In other words, what does this term inherent existence mean? Because that is where you have a misunderstanding. So here, Jerenpuche is expressing surprise at the non-Prasangikas so as to get them, to encourage them, to look at what is meant by inherent existence. And here we are reminded that if something were inherently existent, it would be independent and unchanging. Then what does independent mean? It means it wouldn't be dependent, which means it wouldn't be dependent on causes and conditions. It wouldn't be dependent on something else. So that implication then is something that is inherently existent or independent, that would not be impacted by anything else. Causes and conditions would have no impact on it. It would be independent. And this, if this is your belief, you non-Prasangikas, so now investigate. See if this is correct or not. If there are phenomena that are independent that are independent, investigate and investigate again and again, because just not because when you investigate and you investigate in detail, you will not find anything that exists by way of its own self-nature. And you need to do this investigation repeatedly over a sustained period on many different objects to gain certainty that there's no phenomenon that can be found that exists by way of its own nature, that exists inherently. So therefore, Ajahn Rinpoche here is encouraging the non-prasangika Buddhists to not dismiss this teaching, but having faith in the Buddha, then they understand the Buddha taught this for a purpose. So investigate these teachings to come to see whether they're true or not. Receive many teachings, reflect on these teachings, and eventually meditate on these teachings. And then they will come to realize the view of the prasangika.
Labja Karachi, Yeah, ジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャンジャン ဒီနေ့အားကြီးနတ်တင်တကယ်နမ်ရှာဆမ်သားချာချာဒါမီပြီးငါဆိုဒါဆက်ဒီငါဆက်ဒီကနေ
coming to the end of our time together this weekend, and this summarize what we've been hearing in how to meditate on these classes. So we've had a few meditations presented. So we'll present now a slightly different meditation that one may choose to engage in. So first of all, one can start out reflecting on impermanence. So there's impermanence that is coarse impermanence that we observe, and there's the subtle impermanence that everything changes moment by moment by moment, that all impermanent phenomena change moment by moment. This is not something that we can observe with our sense consciousnesses, but phenomena are not static. And this understanding then leads us to our own situation in the sense that this life that we have, this too is impermanent. We may have a sense that we have some time ahead of us. We know death will come, but it's a way away. This is a mistaken presumption. And here we need to remind ourselves that our time here is limited and can end at any moment. There is no certainty as to our remaining lifespan. And this then we can use as an impetus to the next step in the meditation is to reflect on the situation that we do have, this preciousness of this human rebirth that we have. And that this human rebirth has such incredible potential. And we can think here about the attainment of a state freed of suffering, or the attainment of the state of enlightenment where we can be of greatest benefit to all beings. In this way we can remind ourselves of the incredible opportunity that we have with this life. But this opportunity that we have, this didn't just come about. It wasn't bestowed upon us, or come about causelessly. This life we have, this opportunity that we have, it also is a dependent arising, dependent on causes and conditions. And our future life too is dependent on causes and conditions that we have created and are creating. So with this reflection, we're turning our mind now to dependency once again, and we're generating a positive and strong mind. And this is needed at the beginning of the meditation so as to power us through the rest of the meditation. So here we can then think that to be of real benefit to ourselves as well as others, to live what remains of this life in a meaningful way, we need to utilize our remaining time as well as possible. And we need to do this, and the way to do this is to continue to accumulate causes that will lead to happiness. And not only causes that will lead to temporary samsaric happiness, but causes that enable our spiritual progression, whereby we can be of ever greater benefit to others. So here then we can engage in a meditation on the various causes that we need to accumulate to ensure that we have good rebirths in our future lives and can continue our spiritual progression. And the starting point is to cultivate a commitment not to bring harm to others. knowing that we don't want to suffer, nor does anyone else. We make the commitment to guard our mind, to subdue our mind, to tame our mind, to ensure that our mind doesn't go in a harmful direction. And thereby ensure that physically we don't bring harm to others, and our verbal communication doesn't bring harm to others. And this is the practice of ethical conduct, where we subdue our mind and we prevent ourselves from bringing harm to others. The more we reflect on this, just like the illustration with the scale, the stronger this mind of ethical conduct becomes, then the stronger the causes for a good rebirth as a human or God we accrue. So this then is the first reflection, that the developing of an ethical attitude. Then this accompanying mind, the second reflection here, this is that not only do I commit not to bring harm to others, but I commit to benefit others whenever I can within the confines of my current capacity. And this is the cultivation of the mind of generosity, where we generate the wish that whenever I can physically act to help others in a way that's in accordance with my abilities, I will do so. With my way of verbally communicating, I'll ensure that this is beneficial and helps others. And this is to be motivated by a way of thinking which is an altruistic mind, a mind that wants to bring benefit to others. And this way of thinking, this practice is the practice of generosity, and it can be expressed not just in the material way that we generally think about generosity, but also in our way of communicating, our way of thinking. And this creates causes that lead to results. So it's a dependency. The results that come from generosity is that in our future rebirths, we will have favorable circumstances for not just a comfortable life, but to aid our spiritual development. Moreover, in this life, it will bring the practice of generosity, this wish to be of benefit to others, will bring happiness to us as well as to others. So in this life and future lives. And this is the case for generosity as well as the preceding practice of ethical conduct. And then thirdly, the practice of patience. So the practice of patience is a mental activity, just like generosity and ethics, where one develops a mind, develops an attitude that remains undisturbed in the face of adversity, whether we're encountering problems and difficulties from others, or we're having difficulties engaging in practice, for example, or our mind is unhappy. All these hardships that we do encounter, we develop an attitude of wanting to, of developing patience, developing a mind that stays undisturbed no matter what the adversity, whether it's from an external or an internal cause. And this leads to happiness for ourselves in this life due to our changing way of interacting with the world and events in the world. This means we bring happiness to the lives of others in this life. Moreover, we create the causes for, in our future lives, to have obstacles to our spiritual progression being overcome, such as our sense powers, such as sight and hearing, being fully developed, being attractive to others, having harmonious relationships to others. So patience, like the other practices, also leads to happiness for ourselves and others in this and future lives. And then fourthly is the practice of joyous perseverance, which is, again, a mental practice, a mind that takes delight in virtue. And here we generate the attitude wanting to engage in virtue, wanting to accumulate the causes that lead to happiness in future lives, wanting to accumulate causes that enable us to bring greater benefit to others in this and future lives. So the mind of joyous perseverance is a mind that takes delight in virtue. And this is the fourth meditation, and also leads to greater happiness for oneself and others in this and future lives. Then the fifth mind is the mind of concentration. So this is the way to cultivate this for ourselves who are not currently engaging in the cultivation of single-pointed concentration, is whichever meditation we are engaging in, when we come to the conclusion of that particular point, whether it's joyous perseverance or patience or generosity or ethics, whatever we're meditating on, and a feeling for that practice arises within us, then we just rest with that. We abide on that. And this serves, one, to strengthen our concentration, but it also strengthens the depth of that realization, our familiarity with that realization. And this is how we can cultivate ever stronger concentration. And the sixth practice is wisdom, which is a meditation on emptiness through dependent arising. So we've gone through that meditation this morning and last night, so I don't need to mention it again now. But these are six meditations that we can engage in on a daily basis, starting out as a preliminary to these six, reflecting on impermanence to generate strength of mind. And then a final point we can include in this meditation is that of bodhicitta, which again we spoke about last night. So this then would be a way that you can include the entire meditation, the entire weekend's teachings, into a single meditation. And we'll conclude here for the weekend then. If you have some questions, then please feel free to ask. Okay, then we can... As there aren't questions, I'd like to take this opportunity just to repeat what we did last night and recite some Om Mani Mantras together for His Holiness's long life. So, yeah, if we can do that then together. Thank you.